This is VOA News. I'm Tommy McNeil. U.S. President Trump says maybe a Christmas gift announced by North Korean leader Kim Jong-un will be something nice rather than a missile. AP correspondent Jackie Quinn.
After North Korea's leader warned he would take action if sanctions are not eased by the end of the year, the speculation is that the Christmas gift he's promised the U.S. would likely be a new missile test, perhaps a missile capable of delivering a nuclear warhead. When asked how the U.S. will respond, President Trump said maybe Kim Jong-un is planning a nice present, like a beautiful vase rather than a missile launch. A U.N. spokesman says the world body has a Christmas message for Pyongyang. It should work for peace and stability on the Korean Peninsula and resume disarmament talks with the United States. Jackie Quinn, Washington.
U.S. President Trump berated Democratic lawmakers over his impeachment Tuesday as a legislative standoff continues over the Senate impeachment trial. Mr. Trump, speaking from his private club, Mar-a-Lago, says that House Speaker Nancy Pelosi is not a fan of his political party.
She hates the Republican Party. She hates all of the people that voted for me and the Republican Party.
On a near straight party line vote, the Democrat-controlled House of Representatives approved two articles of impeachment against Mr. Trump last Wednesday, making him only the third U.S. president to be impeached in the country's 243-year history. Officials in Burkina Faso say that soldiers killed 80 Islamic State militants who launched simultaneous attacks on a military post. The militants killed at least 35 civilians, mostly women, before they were beaten back. Seven soldiers were also killed. Islamic militants in Mali, under pressure from French forces, have spilled across the border into Burkina Faso. This is VOA News. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres is calling for an immediate halt in fighting in northwestern Syria, where a government offensive has pushed tens of thousands of people from their homes in the past week. A Guterres spokesman said Monday he is alarmed by the scale of the military operation and reported attacks on evacuation routes as civilians try to flee north to safety. The Syrian government is trying to retake control of Idlib province, the last area that remains under rebel control from the civil war that began in 2011. And 3 million people live in Idlib, including many who relocated there after fleeing violence in other parts of the country. A Russian court has extended the pretrial detention of former U.S. Marine Paul Whelan until March 29th as he faces espionage charges. Whelan was arrested in December 2018 after accepting a flash drive from an acquaintance which he said thought contained holiday photos, which Russian authorities allege contained classified materials. Whelan has denied the charges against him, and during court appearances and through his lawyer, he has claimed mistreatment by prison officials and Russian security services during his detention. Russia has dismissed his accusations and said Whelan was making them up as part of a mass disinformation campaign. If convicted of espionage, Whelan faces the possibility of 10 to 20 years in prison. Some new Navy submarines will take the names of Pearl Harbor battleships, AP's Ed Donahue explains.
The USS Arizona and the USS Oklahoma were two of the biggest casualties of the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor in 1941. Acting Secretary of the Navy Thomas Modley says two new nuclear fast attack submarines will be designated USS Oklahoma SSN 802 and USS Arizona SSN 803. In a statement, Modley says it's his fondest wish that the citizens of the great states of Arizona and Oklahoma will understand and celebrate the Navy's desire to memorialize the 1,177 heroes who perished on the USS Arizona and the 429 more on the USS Oklahoma. I'm Ed Donahue.
The Christian faithful flocked to Palestinian-governed Bethlehem in the West Bank to celebrate Christmas. Christmas Eve celebrations got off to a festive start at Manger Square. Palestinian Boy and Girl Scouts marched past the Christmas tree in front of the ancient Church of the Nativity, the traditional birthplace of Jesus Christ. Local Palestinians watched the parade along with pilgrims from around the world. Find more at voanews.com. I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News. We'll be right back.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to this holiday edition of Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Wednesday, December 25th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. The popularity of black African churches in London keeps growing. David Muir is a theology lecturer at the University of Roehampton. Historians and archaeologists in Botswana are cautious about a study claiming human origins. The largest historically black college in the United States welcomes international students, and Ghana's Year of Return campaign helped boost international arrivals in the country. Two South African sisters shine in a male-dominated diamond business, and Rwanda's government gives a boost to electric cars and motorcycles. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. The largest concentration of black African churches outside of Africa can be found in South London. Each week, about 20,000 people attend one of the mostly Pentecostal churches in the city. Martha van der Wolf has more from London.
There's prayer, but also lots of singing and dancing at the majority black African churches in South London. The House of Praise is one of those churches where hundreds of people gather each Sunday. Precious Ogbomna is of Nigerian heritage and has been attending for more than 2 years. She likes that there's a connection to the African continent.
It gives you a slice of home. So your parents raise you up in a certain culture, and sometimes you can feel a bit alienated outside or somewhere else, and it just feels like home, really.
Many English churches seem to have a declining congregation, but the African churches in South London are growing in popularity due to the large diaspora community residing in this part of London. Public theology lecturer David Muir explains what makes the diaspora churches stand out.
First and foremost, the diversity of these churches. I mean, some churches have got 20 people, some have got maybe 6, but of course there are other churches with 600 plus. So the kind of diversity of those churches is one thing. The second thing is that most of these churches are actually keen to get involved in social action, and they tend to do that in terms of things like education and welfare. But I think what I found very interesting in the churches is the way in which they take mission seriously. A lot of these folks feel that God has actually sent them here to evangelize the local population.
The churches are quite active in the community. Besides Bible study, the House of Praise provides language classes. They also organize other activities such as soup kitchens to feed the homeless. At the House of Praise, like many other churches, more than 80% of the worshippers have African heritage. Assistant Pastor Benga Samuel sees a role for the church to better integrate the diaspora and indigenous community.
We're kind of the seed that was sown by those who brought the gospel earlier on, and we're kind of the fruits of those seeds. We're bringing it back and trying to bring Christ back into the center of everything that is done.
Many of the majority black churches do not own traditional church buildings. The House of Praise bought a former bingo hall to host its congregation. Others use schools or community centers. Perhaps the lack of space in London might in the future be the one thing that will integrate local and diaspora churches. Marta van der Wolf for VOA News, London.
A study in the Journal of Nature tracing the origins of modern human life to Botswana has drawn mixed views from experts in the Southern African nation. The study, based on genetics, points to human life emerging around an ancient massive lake in northern Botswana. Some archaeologists, however, question the study's findings. Nkundise Dube reports from the Makadikadi Basin in Botswana.
The Makadikadi Basin's dry, salty flats stretch across much of northern Botswana. But a study by the journal Nature published in October says this area was once a lush wetland and the place where the earliest humans emerged. Local diamond miner Justice Modise is excited about the finding.
I've always thought there's something special about this place, because having been there a number of times and looking at the beauty, it's such a beautiful place, and you can't help but wonder what started here. I honestly believe that it's true that life started here.
Earlier archaeological digs point to East Africa as the earliest known origins of humans. The study in Nature is based on genetic findings rather than archaeological evidence, and University of Botswana history professor Fred Morton raises some caution about the conclusion.
To me, the argument is a bit suspicious without some kind of additional evidence to support the genetics.
But while there is caution, local archaeologists like Philip Sikadeka say the report should spare further research of evidence from the area.
We are not shocked that the Makadikadi would be a potential candidate in talking about the ancient and antiquity of man. Because, I mean, the whole of the Makadikadi is replete with artifacts and archaeological sites, Middle Stone Age sites and Early Stone Age sites that go as far back as, 200,000 years back.
While experts debate if human origins were in Eastern or Southern Africa, the study is already sparking interest among tourists visiting Northern Botswana.
There was this article also saying that apparently human beings all come from here. So for us, it's very interesting to come here and see that, it's we all start from one place and I'm kind of home, kind of.
Mkondisi Dube for VOA News, Makadikadi Basin, Botswana.
2019 is the 400th anniversary of the first enslaved Africans to be brought to what is now the United States, arriving in the English colony of Virginia. In Ghana, the anniversary has been dubbed the Year of Return, with the country welcoming the African diaspora with expedited visas and numerous events to discover their roots, even if they do not know their lineage is Ghanaian. Aisha Saraya went to Accra to speak with some of the people bridging the gap between the continents.
I don't specifically know exactly where I would have been from in Africa.
I've always assumed that I'm West African.
The biannual PanaFest in Ghana celebrates the idea of Pan-Africanism. But this year, the festival takes on a new meaning as Ghana welcomes members of the African diaspora, many of whom don't know where their ancestors came from before being enslaved, to discover their roots.
For me, it's a trip of a lifetime. I've always fixated on Ghana as a place that I wanted to visit for a long time.
It's amazing to begin to reconnect with family, if you will, and seeing people leave from all over the world.
His Excellency, the President of the Republic of Ghana, Nana Addo-Dankwa Akufo-Addo, declared 2019 as the year of return for all African Americans and Africans in the diaspora.
When I look at Pan-Africanism, I look at it from the context of unity.
Gail Nikoi, who moved to Ghana from the U.S., heads Ghana's African American Association.
We are all part of the black race. We are all Africans, right? Whether you're an African in America, whether you're an African in Brazil, whether you're African in the Caribbean, if you have a high level of melanin in your skin, you are from Africa.
Nikoi has been working with Ghanaians and other Americans living in Ghana to organize a year of events commemorating African unity on the continent and among the diaspora. Many of the attendees say they were pleasantly surprised by how Accra has shattered their stereotypes of the African continent.
A lot of the somers, a lot of the concepts, perceptions, even the African Americans, black folks in America think about Africa, right? So that it's all Sudan, it's all jungle, which is not the case.
In addition to events in Ghana's capital, a big part of the Year of Return involves traveling to Cape Coast to see the notorious castle used in the transatlantic slave trade. Now a museum showcasing the plight of enslaved Africans before they were taken from the continent forever.
When they come to this place, it's like a pilgrimage, because to many of them, they can only come here once in a lifetime. So when they come here, this place is very important to them, very emotional.
The sense of pilgrimage is felt by many visitors.
It's just really amazing to see, this is happening at this point in history. And I mean, for me, it's the full circle of things coming to where they belong. And I feel really a strong sense of belonging here.
Isha Sarai, VOA News, Accra.
You are listening to a holiday edition of Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today's Wednesday, December 25th. Historically black colleges and universities, or HBCUs, are facing declining enrollments, as are many other American universities. But North Carolina A&T, the largest HBCU in the United States, has boasted of growth as it continues to welcome international students to its campus. Aisha Saraya has more from Greensboro. Most
North Carolina A&T, the country's largest historically black university, has been welcoming international students for decades.
We have had as many as 50 countries represented, and this semester we actually have 36 countries. Again, there are close to 320 international students moving about our campus.
A&T, which stands for Agricultural and Technical, produces the most black engineers of any university in the country. The school's strong science and engineering programs have hosted a wide range of international students seeking master's and doctoral degrees.
I was also looking for a school that was culturally diverse because I was traveling for the first time. So I needed an environment that would promote diversity and accept people from all kinds of cultural backgrounds.
I feel more at home here. You know, staying in the midst of people, sharing same ideas as I am, and also not being like feeling inferior because of color or skin color or whatever. I feel at home here.
Enrollment by international students at U.S. universities has fallen this year, and despite A&T's reputation, the school also expects a slight decline for the next academic year.
Part of that is due to the stronger immigrations and visa interview requirements, but primarily funding and financial support for international students interested in coming to the university.
But the department remains confident that, especially given the school's overall growth in recent years, international students will continue to choose A&T for their studies. Isha Sarai, VOA News, Greensboro, North Carolina.
Sibudi Joe Matole and Komotso Ramadipa are rare gems in the male-dominated diamond industry. The South African sisters run one of the few women-owned diamond polishing businesses in the world. And despite the slumping global market for diamonds and a shrinking industry in South Africa, they have managed to keep shining and developing new female talent. Maris de Klerk reports from Bedford View, South Africa.
Stunning, eh?
Beautiful.
I know it.
A passion for diamonds drove South African sisters Mosibudi Joe Matole and Khumotso Ramodipa to drop their careers as an investment banker and an optometrist. After qualifying as diamond valuators in 2008, they started a cutting and polishing shop, Kwame Diamonds, the first and only one run by sisters in South Africa. Entering this industry is not easy, explains the company's founder and director, Mosibudi Joe Matole.
Barriers to entry go beyond just being a woman or being a man, because the difficulty, it boils down to having an outfit like this, you really need a proper capital outlay. And for women, it becomes a bit tricky because this has always been a very male-dominated industry.
But seeing challenges as opportunities, the sisters cut their way into the diamond industry, selling only responsibly sourced certified stones bought from mining companies operating in South Africa. Kwame Diamonds carved out a niche in cutting and polishing fancy and bespoke cut diamonds. They are also accredited to cut and polish the world-renowned De Beers Group's branded diamonds, says co-owner and director Komotso Ramodipa.
To produce a Forever Mark diamond, which according to them, it's 1% of the world diamonds that are produced. If you are able to polish that kind of diamond, then you are among one of the best.
Toli and Ramodipa employ and empower women in the diamond industry by developing their skills. Diamond polisher Grace Tsekhu's repertoire now includes more than the round cut.
Now I can go out there and say, I'm a diamond cutter. I'm even specializing with fancy cut. That's something that it's so wow, because other people, they don't know it.
Globally, polished diamonds' profit margins are declining. The South African industry shrank from 4,500 polishers 25 years ago to only 250 polishers today. But the sister-run Kwame Diamonds has managed to not only stay in the market, but gain a reputation for innovation, according to the president of the World Federation of Diamond Bursars, Ernie Blom.
They're looking at the diamond industry from a different perspective. They're thinking out of the box, and maybe they're ticking all the right boxes that is giving them the success that they have. And maybe that's what a lot of the older diamond industry can learn from.
Many in South Africa's diamond industry fear a lack of growth will cause a shortage of jobs for trained diamond talent. Matoli disagrees.
How you approach the business is what will set you apart. So yes, it is shrinking, but we are here not to shrink. We are here to make sure that we expand.
These dynamic sisters are determined to prove not just that diamonds are girls' best friend, but that the industry is a place where women can shine. Marise de Klerk for VOA News, Bedford View, South Africa.
Rwanda's government is getting behind the carbon neutral movement by promoting electric cars and motorcycles. German automaker Volkswagen is demonstrating electric vehicles in Kigali, while a local company has begun selling electric bikes. Will the vehicles work in a city with a dense population and poor road system? Ruud Elmedor went to Kigali to try and find answers.
We're on the parking lot of the Kigali International Convention Center. Rwandan Prime Minister Edouard Ngirente steps in a Volkswagen electric car and maneuvers it around with no problems, like it was his own. And this is the official launch of a pilot program by Volkswagen. The company is putting 4 electric cars on the road for Kigali residents to try out through the Uber-like Move service. And if all goes well, the automaker will roll out another 50 electric cars to be powered by 15 charging stations. Ngirente says electric cars will be a step forward in Rwanda's drive to become less dependent on carbon-emitting fossil fuels.
Rwandans are becoming increasingly aware that protecting the environment is a top priority.
Arrival of the e-cars follows the introduction of electric motorcycles in Rwanda. Because of a poor road system and dense population, 70% of Kigali residents rely on motorbikes to get around. Kigali-based Ampersand is one of the companies hoping to see the public switch to electric-powered bikes. They look cool with a classy design and are manufactured partly in India, partly in Rwanda. The cost, around $1,000. Ampersand CEO Josh Wolf says that these motorcycles fulfill a need.
The motorcycles are simply cheaper to acquire and cheaper to operate, but actually have more power and more performance than the current petrol motorcycles used.
The e-bikes use a battery that lasts for about 75 kilometers of driving. Despite the limitations, Emmanuel Dayambaza says he's happy. He says he loves the electric bike because it's good. It requires little maintenance, and he says he makes more money than with a fuel motorbike. Battery life is one of the challenges for Ampersand. They're working on increasing the capacity and having more than the current 2 charging stations. The Ministry of Infrastructure is monitoring the progress with the e-bikes. If found suitable, it will start promoting them, says Ministry official Alfred Biriangiro.
After the realizing that electric motorcycle can be used on our terrain, which is a hilly terrain, we just entice people on advantages of using electric bikes and electric motorcycles.
Ampersand hopes to have 500 e-bikes on the road next year, but they might feel competition from the electric cars, according to Volkswagen Sub-Saharan Africa CEO Thomas Schaefer.
People are tired of sitting on the back of a motorbike and having a bad helmet here, and it rains, and the buses are sometimes full, so the take-up is amazing.
While for now motorcycles remain king of the road in Rwanda, e-cars and e-bikes are gaining ground and may lead the country to an electric, carbon-neutral future. Ruth Almendorp for VOA News, Kigali, Rwanda.
That's it for this Wednesday, December 25th holiday edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clarty and Reiki Shryak, as well as post editor Samson O'Malley, along with all of our engineers, I am James Botte in Washington, wishing you and your families joyous holidays.
Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for an hour of awesome African music. Wake up, dance this music. Like to stay on top of new music trends, breakout artists, new releases? Maybe you just love the classic styles and artists of the past. Or simply the sound and feel of a good beat. Whatever your pleasure, you can get it every week right here on Music Time in Africa. So join me on your local FM station, Saturdays and Sundays at 1500 and 2000 UTC.